easy life, but to take up their cross and follow Christ. But what keeps them going in that challenging calling is the hope of future glory. A new birth into a living hope, Peter calls it. And that living hope is what tonight's section focuses on. As it says in the second half of verse 13, set your hope fully, completely, on the grace to be given you when Jesus is revealed. Well, we need something to live for. What people write on their suicide notes is, I had nothing to live for. Suicide, incidentally, is the biggest cause of death for men in the UK under the age of 50. And we need hope for life to be worth living. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish professor of psychiatry who was sent to Auschwitz and other concentration camps in World War II. And he wrote about his experiences afterwards in a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And he writes this: the prisoner who had lost his faith in the future was doomed. With the loss of belief in the future, he lost his spiritual hold on life, and that led to mental and physical decline. We all dreaded this. It began when the prisoner refused to get up in the morning for parade. He just lay there, and no threats or blows had any effect. I had a dramatic demonstration of this with my block commander, F., a fairly well-known composer and librettist. One day he came to me and said, "Doctor, I've had a strange dream. A voice came to me and said it would answer any question that I asked." And so I asked when our camp would be liberated. Frankl asked, "What did your dream voice answer?" "March the 30th. This conversation took place at the beginning of March. "When F told me this," said Frankl, he was full of hope and convinced that the voice would be right. But as the date drew nearer, the war news which reached us made it extremely unlikely that we would be free on that date. On March 29th, F suddenly became ill and ran a high temperature. On March 30th, the day that his prophecy had told him the camp would be freed, he became delirious and lost consciousness. On March 31st, he was dead. To all outward appearances, he had died of typhus. We need hope, we need faith in the future, something to live for. I quoted Nietzsche in an earlier sermon, who said, "If we have a why, we can bear almost any how. If we know what we're living for, then almost any hardship is endurable." So tonight I want to look at the content of Christian hope and the difference it makes. Many of you will remember Jonathan Croucher, who was with us as a curate for 4 years until 2012. And for the first half of that time, he was a senior lawyer in a big city law firm. And when he was thinking about giving up as a lawyer and becoming a full-time vicar, he quoted to several of his close colleagues a phrase we use here sometimes, which is, "The local church is the hope of the world." They were completely dismissive of this statement. They said, "You must be joking, the local church, the hope of the world? That is ridiculous." So he said to them, "Well, okay, what's your hope? You tell me." And he said they became very angry and defensive because they had no answer to the question. They didn't have a hope. They just tried not to think about it most of the time. They knew you can't really invest your life in the success of the firm or your pension or whatever. And so they had no answer when he asked them what their hope was. The American novelist Marilyn Robinson said recently that Christians must be ambassadors of hope in the world. She said the US is a society full of fear. It's probably why Donald Trump is doing so well. But she said Christians can offer hope, the antidote to fear. And Peter puts our future hope at the center of our Christian life. One commentator writes that for Peter, faith and hope are almost synonymous. Faith is hope, and hope is faith. And I guess we can see that in the last verse of this section, verse 21. "Through him," that's Jesus, "you believe in God who raised him from the dead and glorified him, and so your faith and hope are in God. They're really pretty much the same thing. If you believe that Jesus is alive and reigns and will return in glory, then hope has to be the dominant note in your faith. So what I want to do tonight is look in some detail at verse 13, which I think is the key verse, and then look at three aspects that Peter refers to in Christian hope, which are holiness, justice, and a true home. So let's look first at this rather interesting verse, verse 13. Therefore, which refers back to the previous paragraph, because of the good news that you've received, prepare your minds for action. Prepare your minds for action. What it literally says is gird up the loins of your mind. You know, that's a pretty odd expression, isn't it? Gird up the loins of your mind. And it refers to the days when people wore long robes, and if they wanted to run, they had to gather up all their robes before they could run, so they didn't get all tangled up. And so, you know, prepare your minds for action is quite a good effort. The Message version says, roll up your sleeves and put your mind in gear. But the point is, the mind is central. You know, you need to get your hope clear. So it says, prepare your mind for action, or gird up the loins of your mind. Then it says, be self-controlled, and that is literally be sober. And I guess to be sober is to be clear-minded, not to be fuzzy or hazy in your thinking as you are when you're drunk. Or I should say you, we are, when we're drunk. But there may be an echo here of Jesus' teaching in Luke 12 when he talks about the servant who should be looking forward to his master's return, but instead he gets drunk and begins to beat his fellow servants. Don't be drunk, don't be unclear, be clear and sober-minded about where your future hope is. And so he says in the rest of the verse, set your hope fully on the grace to be given to you when Jesus Christ is revealed. It's striking to me that those colleagues of Jonathan I mentioned earlier, all very able, successful people, and yet they were completely unclear in their minds about where their hope was. I've mentioned before Francis Spufford's book, Unapologetic, which is a defense of the Christian faith, and there's a bit in there that I think resonates with this. He says, to many people, faith appears to be a kind of anxious pretending, a kind of continual nervous resistance to reality. In other words, people think that believers are in denial of reality. But to me, he says, the funny thing is that belief involves the most uncompromising attention to the nature of things of which you're capable, the most uncompromising attention to the nature of things of which you're capable. Belief demands that you dispense with illusion after illusion, while contemporary common sense requires continual fluffy pretending. So he's saying belief demands that we get really clear in our thinking about reality around us, present and future reality. And that's really what Peter is saying here. Gird up the loins of your mind. Set your hope fully on what is to come. So let's look at those three aspects of future hope: holiness, justice, and a true home. First, holiness. At the end of that paragraph, it says, be holy because I am holy. If you're a Christian, you understand that at the center of the universe and sustaining every moment of everything every day is a God who is perfectly good. That's the essence of his character, pure, burning, dangerous goodness. And that holiness of God affects everything around it. In the Old Testament, the temple where God dwelt became holy. The city around the temple, Jerusalem, became the holy city. And God's people around that became a holy people. In other words, God's holiness, God's goodness, is infectious. And the phrase, be holy because I am holy, comes from the book of Leviticus, as you'll see from the footnote. And it's a kind of refrain in that book, repeated several times through the book. And you may know that the book is a list of cleanliness laws. Don't touch this, wear that, wash this, offer this sacrifice, don't eat that, you can eat that. All about what it means to be clean, to be pure. And that's what it means to be like God. Well, when Jesus comes, all those cleanness laws are suddenly swept away, and he says they're all gone because their purpose has been fulfilled. And of course, the purpose is to point forward to him, the one who is truly pure, truly good, truly holy. And so, you know, that's what it means to live a truly holy, pure and good life. He's a lamb without blemish or defect, it says just over the page. And that is the holiness that his people are to reflect and to be infected with. So it's not just about an outward religious set of rules or behaviors or ceremonies. It's about true inner goodness. And you can see that in verses 14 to 15. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all that you do. So it affects everything you do, verse 15, and it's about your desires, verse 14. In most religions, it doesn't really matter what you think inside. As long as you do the right things, you go to the temple, you give away some of your money, you perform the right rituals, that's really it. No one could expect you to be pure in your inner desires. That would be far too much to ask. But Christianity says that's exactly what you're striving towards. Obedient children is literally children of obedience. That's your very character, your inner nature. And holiness that we're called to reflects God's character, his truthfulness, his faithfulness, his purity, his concern for others, right down at the deepest level of our desires. And that's how and why we need to prepare our minds for action, to be clear on the character of God, the holiness of God, so that we can live lives that are truthful and faithful and pure. Not just on the outside through our rituals, but through the reality of our desires and our thinking. Otherwise, Peter says, we'll just fall in with everyone else in the evil, foolish, selfish, impure desires we had when we lived in ignorance. We know how easy it is to go that way, isn't it? Unless we get our minds clear on our hope that God at the center of the universe is perfectly holy. But if we do live like that, if we do live lives of faithfulness and truth and purity, don't you think it will shine out? Don't you think people at work will notice it? So that's the first aspect of our hope that changes our lives now, the holiness of God at the center of the universe. Don't be conformed to the evil desires you had before, but be holy. And the second aspect is justice and judgment. There is a judge who will bring justice at the end of all things. Verse 17, since you call on a father who judges each person's work impartially, live your lives as strangers here in reverent fear. There is a judge who will judge everyone impartially. And that affects everything. It's not just an intellectual question about whether there is a God who will judge us at the end. In the end, it's a moral question. You know, if there's no God, then in a sense, all moral choices are meaningless. When we're dead, we're dead. It doesn't really matter how we've lived. Arthur Miller expresses this perfectly in his play After the Fall, where a character called Quentin says, "For years, I thought life was like a law case. You had to prove how brave you are, or how smart, then what a good lover, then what a good father, and finally how wise or powerful you are. You had to prove that. But underlying it all, I see now, was a presumption that I was heading somewhere towards a verdict, a judgment. I think now that my disaster began when I looked up one day and saw that the bench was empty. No judge in sight. And all that was left was an endless argument with myself, the pointless litigation before an empty bench, which is another way of saying despair." So there's no judgment. There's no judge at the end. Then the result is despair. And despair, of course, is the opposite of hope. Now, of course, we can't live as if none of our moral decisions matter. We have to believe that there are universal values, that peace is better than war, that telling the truth is better than lying, that caring for people is better than destroying them. But why do we live like that? You know, if there's nothing else, then the whole span of civilization is an infinitesimally small pinprick in relation to the oceans of dead time before and after our lives. And no one will remember anything, and so it can't matter how we live or what we do. Without judgment at the end, our lives are empty. And that's what Peter says in verse 18, you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down by your forefathers. If we have no hope of judgment, then our lives are empty and our actions are meaningless. Now, it's just worth pausing to say that, of course, judgment by a perfectly holy God in itself would fill us with dread, wouldn't it? Because which of us could stand before him? So look again at how Peter puts it in verse 17. Since you call on a Father who judges each one's work impartially, you call on him as your Father. And that is a great reassurance to us. He has made us his children through Christ and will never leave us. And that's why we can face judgment without complete paralyzing terror, with what Peter here calls reverent fear, rather than soul-destroying dread. It does fill us with awe to know that our actions will be judged, that everything we've done and said and even thought will be revealed, that there will be great rewards for those who've been faithful, and that those who are frauds will be exposed. It does fill us with reverent fear. And yet we don't have to dread it, because we know that in Christ we can stand, not in our goodness, but in his goodness. And that sense of waiting for judgment gives our lives tremendous dignity and worth, and every action, even the smallest actions we do, matter. So that's the second aspect of hope. There is a judgment that all of us are heading to. Then the third aspect is looking forward to a true home. Live your lives as strangers here, says Peter in verse 17. And that, of course, is how he starts the letter, to God's elect, strangers in the world. This world is not our home. We're living for somewhere else. Our true home is somewhere else. And the word is literally sojourners, or temporary residents. People who know they're just passing through this world. Our lives here are temporary, and we should see them in that way. There's an old Indian proverb which says, life is a bridge, cross over it, but don't build your house on it. But of course, if this world is all we hope for, then we will build our house on it. What else can we do? And we'll end up devoting our lives to the temporary things of this world. We'll invest everything in them. They'll become our supreme values and drivers. And when we lose them, it will be devastating to us. But not if we are strangers here. We're living for something better, for a true home. Verse 18. For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Not with perishable things, such as silver or gold. In other words, Peter is saying that gold, one of the most long-lasting and highly valued things in this world, is really just temporary. It's perishable. Don't invest your life in these things. You're strangers here, and you have a true home with an inheritance that can never be taken away from you. In 1519, Cortes and his conquistadors invaded Mexico, a hitherto isolated world. And the Aztecs who lived there quickly noticed that these new alien invaders showed an extraordinary interest in a certain yellow metal, and they never seemed to stop talking about it. The Aztecs used gold mainly for jewelry and statues, but not for money. They used cocoa beans for money. And they said, well, what use is a metal, really, that is too soft for tools or weapons? And when they questioned Cortes about the Spanish passion for gold, He answered this, "It's because my companions and I have a disease of the heart that can only be cured by gold." A disease of the heart that can only be cured by gold. Don't give your life to the temporary things of this world. The treasures in your true home will never perish or spoil. So keep your mind focused on that as your true hope and your true home. And then you'll have a right attitude to the things of this world. So set your mind fully on that hope. Hope of the holiness of God, which means that faithfulness and truth and purity matter. And we seek to live lives that reflect that. The justice of God, which gives dignity to even our smallest actions. And our true home, which means that we're strangers here. We don't live for the temporary things of today. Now I want to close by taking you to a prison camp in Gorlitz in Silesia in the middle of winter 1941, January the 15th. It's freezing cold, one of the bleakest moments in World War II. And among the prisoners, French prisoner, was a Catholic musician called Olivier Messiaen. And he wanted to give the prisoners hope at this darkest hour in the war. And he was reading the book of Revelation, and he saw in that book that a time would come when time itself would disappear. And so he wrote one of the greatest 20th century pieces of music called A Quartet for the End of Time. It was written for very unusual instruments, the only four instruments they had. A cello with three strings instead of four, a piano with two notes that stuck together, a violin he'd got by pawning some ration tickets in a local village, and a very battered clarinet. And reflecting later on that first performance, Messiaen said, "The cold was excruciating, the stalag buried under snow. The piece played on broken down instruments. The keys of the piano went down and didn't come back up again. But," he said, "never have I had an audience who listened with such rapt attention and comprehension." Comprehension. They got it. Their minds were focused on their hope. They knew there was something beyond that snowy prison camp in Poland. And that hope kept them going. You can endure almost anything if you have hope. So gird up the loins of your mind. Be clear-minded and set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. Let us be ambassadors of hope in a world that is full of fear. Just read the last two verses. "Jesus was chosen before the creation of the world, but revealed in these last times for your sake. Through him you believe in God, who raised him from the dead and glorified him. And so your faith and hope are in God." And we'll hear that last movement of the Quartet for the End of Time again during communion.